This time we're going to look at 2 Kings. And this is a pretty grim reading because we see the collapse, basically, of the Israelites as different groups take power and come into their territory and wipe them out. And in some cases, haul them off to captivity. So it's tough reading. But maybe we can set this as history. The time of David is roughly 1000 B.C., and the time of the split in the two kingdoms that we talked about last time in 1 Kings would be somewhere around 930 B.C., and so that's where we're living right now as far as the time that we'll look at with Elijah and Elisha and some of the kings, and then eventually we're going to get to Assyria that'll come in 722 B.C., and we'll end with Babylon coming in 586 B.C. So roughly with the time of Kings, we've moved from 1000 B.C. to about 586 B.C., so almost a little over 400 years. So let's pick up then with 2 Kings. Keep in mind that David is gone. Solomon ruled. That was the height of the kingdom. He ruled with a fairly harsh scepter, and so the people, after his departure, asked to be relieved of some of these taxes and tough duties that were laid on them, and the son said no. He had advisors that weren't very helpful. The northern people rebelled, set up a different king. That was called Samaria. The whole area was called Israel, and then the last two tribes that stayed with Solomon's lineage was known as Judah. So we have Judah and we have Israel. So that's some of the background of what we're talking about here. Well, I'm going to pick up in 2 Kings, first couple of chapters. We're introduced, we meet up with Elijah. We covered a little bit of Elijah before, but what I really would like to do, if that's okay, I'd like to save Elijah and Elisha and some of their stories and what they represented and all when we look at prophets in particular. That was such an important part of the Old Testament. I'd like to treat that separately. And so when we get the stories here of Elijah followed by Elisha, let's skip over that. A lot of stories at the beginning of 2 Kings cover these stories of these two, especially Elisha. And then if you notice, right around chapters 8 and 9 and 10, we get things like this. Let me pick up in 2 Kings 8. Jehoram, king of Judah. Ahaziah, king of Judah. Chapter 9, Jehu, appointed king of Israel. Let's go to chapter 11 and 12, or more of the kings. 13, Jehoahaz, king of Israel. Jehoiachin, king of Israel. 14, Amaziah, king of Judah. So do you hear what's going on here? We're getting this litany, this list of the kings. Keep in mind, these are two separate kingdoms now. The northern kingdom, Israel, southern kingdom, Judah. They have kings. They're mostly nondescript. You notice how fast they're going through these people. The people who wrote this don't seem to be very impressed with them. There are no Davids here. There are no Solomons here. There are no powerful, charismatic leaders here. So it's just one after another. You feel like you're not getting anywhere. It makes your head spin. Chapter 15, so-and-so is king of Judah. Somebody else is king of Israel. We get another king of Israel, another king of Israel, another king of Israel, another king of Israel. This is all chapter 15. One more king of Judah. And so it's just one after another. And then let's move down to chapter 17. Okay, so 2 Kings 17. This is not a good sign. In the 12th year, the king comes in. Verse 3, Shalmaneser, king of Assyria, came up to attack Hoshea. Or Hosea. This is not good. What we've had so far is the kings of both Judah and Israel have been left alone since both Egypt and over in Mesopotamia to the west and to the east. These two areas have been fairly quiet and not very dynamic. Well, that's changing. We have now Assyria, major kingdom on the rise, and the Assyrians were scary and a half. These were extremely scary people. That was their idea, to inflict terror so that people wouldn't fight them. And so we encounter Shalmaneser coming in as the king. And then I want you to look at verse 6 of chapter 17. The king of Assyria captured Samaria. Now those are the people of Israel, right? The northern group. And deported them to Assyria. And so they got tossed. And what happens instead, if you look in the second half of 17, starting verse 24, was the king of Assyria, he brings people from all over the place and settles them to replace the people he's pulled out, the natives. So this was Assyria's way of dealing with any potential future uprising. It wasn't enough to beat these people. It wasn't enough to haul some of them off to slavery. It wasn't enough to put somebody in power to watch over them. It wasn't enough to have an army that could come back and squash any rebellion. They yanked people, complete groups of people, out of the land, scattered them throughout their empire, brought other people in so that there was no connection to the land. Wouldn't that just break your heart? You've not only been defeated by an enemy, but they take you away. Imagine how you feel about your homeland, speaking the language, knowing your father, your grandfather, your mother, your grandmother grew up. You knew where they were buried. You knew where they lived. You knew things about their lives. You looked at that land with a grateful heart, with grateful eyes, and then that's all gone. And you're hauled off to captivity. And you spend the rest of your days in an alien land. How horrifying would that be? But that's chapter 17. So this is now roughly 722 BC. Assyria comes. The 10 northern tribes are hauled off. And we see that also in other stories here in the Old Testament. But something to consider is people have messed with the idea of what happened to the lost tribe, lost tribes. And I just find that interesting because nobody knows. I mean, they were just scattered. But every once in a while, somebody comes up with a new theory. Oh, actually, they ended up English, right? They came to England after hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And so you get people that will argue that, and some will argue for this group being the lost tribes and so on. Just do a Google search. Sometime look up lost tribes of Israel, and people spin these interesting stories. But we don't know. Nobody knows. Well, in chapter 17 then, we've seen the people of the northern tribes hauled off. And, of course, Assyria is not done. Chapter 18, if you go to the middle of the chapter here, it says Sennacherib, he's the next king of Assyria, threatens Jerusalem. Okay, so this is not good. And let me pick up here. It says Sennacherib came in verse 15, attacked all the fortified cities of Judah and captured them. So he's got the outlying cities. And now he comes up against Jerusalem. And I want to slow down here because I find this a fascinating section. What he would like to do is to capture Jerusalem without having to go through a siege. I mean, he's going to lose men. It's going to take time. And sometimes when they try sieges, disease will break out in their camp. It's not a sure thing. So it's kind of an iffy deal for them. In this chapter, 18, you're going to see an attempt to get Jerusalem to fall without a fight. And here's how it works. Sennacherib sends up a field commander. And let's pick it up in verse 19. I probably will slow it down here because I think this is so interesting. Listen to the psychological warfare and the propaganda being spun here. You talk about spin masters. This field commander is a master of this. So he's talking to the people who are representing the city of Jerusalem, the administrators, and this is what he says. This is what the great king, the king of Assyria, says. On what are you basing this confidence of yours? You say you have strategy and military strength, but you speak only empty words. On whom are you depending that you rebel against me? Look now. You're depending on Egypt, that splintered reed of a staff which pierces a man's hand and wounds him if he leans on it. Such is Pharaoh, king of Egypt, to all who depend on him. And if you say to me, we are depending on the Lord our God, isn't he the one whose high places and altars Hezekiah removed, saying to Judah and Jerusalem, you must worship before this altar in Jerusalem? Come now, make a bargain with my master, the king of Assyria. I will give you 2,000 horses if you can put riders on them. How can you repulse one officer of the least of my master's officials, even though you are depending on Egypt for chariots and horsemen? Furthermore, have I come to attack and destroy this place without word from the Lord? The Lord himself told me to march against this country and destroy it. So I want you to think about what is being said here. What is the psychological warfare in chapter 18 of 2 Kings that this field commander is pulling? Well, first he says, so you're holding out. You're holding out hoping that the Egyptians will come help you. Remember, there you have two great powers. You have the Egyptians on one side of the children of Israel, and you have, in this case, the Assyrians on the other side. So this field commander says, well, don't depend on the Egyptians. That's the first thing, that you shouldn't depend on. They're weak. And he says, well, what about God? Are you saying you're depending on God? And then he misunderstands. Did you see in verse 22? You depend on the God whose high places and altars got removed. Well, Hezekiah, if you read back on your own, you'll find out he removed the altars and the high places dedicated to the false god, Baal, that Hezekiah did not want the people worshiping. So he's a little mixed up there, but he's trying to trick them anyway. And then verse 23 says, the king will give you 2,000 horses if you can put riders on them. In other words, you probably don't have 2,000 warriors in this place. So he starts belittling them. And then the final piece of psychological warfare, he says, hey, the Lord himself told me to march against this country. Now, I doubt that sincerely, but apparently he knows the name for God of these people, because they're using the L-O-R-D with a capital L-O-R-D, which is Yahweh. So he says, hey, Yahweh told me to come here. Well, that is an attempt, of course, to confuse the people. And then the great response, verse 26, Eliakim, son of Hilkiah, says to this field commander, please speak to your servants in Aramaic, since we understand it. Don't speak to us in Hebrew in the hearing of the people on the wall. Okay, now, what's happening here, this commander has come, and of course people are curious, so they're probably lining up on the wall inside Jerusalem, and he's close enough that they can hear him. So he starts speaking Hebrew. So everything you've heard so far, he is speaking Hebrew in an attempt to scare not only the city leaders, but the city followers, the people up on the walls. And so the leaders of Jerusalem are saying, could we switch over to Aramaic, which was sort of the common lingo there among the commanders and all. We understand that. Don't speak Hebrew, right? Don't let these people hear what you're saying. So the commander's reply is, Was it only to your master and you that my master sent me to say these things and not to the men sitting on the wall? Can you imagine him just pointing out there to the men sitting on the wall, who, like you, will have to eat their own filth and drink their own urine? Now he's talking about, of course, a siege that would take place, that they would get so thirsty they'd be down to drinking their own urine. So once again, psychological warfare. And then the commander appeals directly to these people, verse 28, and he calls out in, do you see it there? Hebrew. Hear the word of the great king, the king of Assyria. This is what the king says. Do not let Hezekiah deceive you. He cannot deliver you from my hand. So now he's going right to the people. Don't let Hezekiah stand up against me. But Jerusalem holds out, and they successfully hold out. And we'll see what happened at the end of chapter 19. It says an angel of the Lord went out and killed off 185,000 men in the Assyrian camp. We don't know if that's hyperbole. It could be something as simple as plague breaking out in the camp. But Sennacherib takes off and goes back to Assyria. What's interesting is later on, Sennacherib wrote of his exploits, had them chiseled into stone, and he says, I trapped Hezekiah like a bird inside a cage. But do you notice what he doesn't say is, I defeated Hezekiah? And that's true. He did coop him up inside Jerusalem, but he didn't succeed. So I just find that a fascinating chapter, 18 and 19 especially. Okay, so let's go beyond that now. Assyria has taken the 10 northern tribes. They've been involved in other fighting. Some time goes by. We'll pick up in chapter 25 to end this section here. Mine is titled The Fall of Jerusalem. So first it was the 10 northern tribes. Judah hangs on for a while. They have some more kings. And then Zedekiah made a huge mistake. He's the current king. in Judah, he decides he's going to put in and throw his lot in with Egypt. Not a good choice. And there's a terrible loss, a battle, and loss as a result. And says, now Zedekiah rebelled against the king of Babylon. So in the ninth year of Zedekiah's reign, on the 10th day of the 10th month, Nebuchadnezzar, now who's this? King of Babylon. Okay, so the Babylonians in the time between what we just read in the chapter 17 and 18 and 19, that's Assyria. Assyria in 722 was the power to mess with. They were not to mess with. They were huge. They're the 2,000-pound gorilla in the room. Don't mess with them. They have fallen. The Babylonians have taken over. We're now at 586 BC, so roughly 150 years have gone by. And so here's poor little Israel. Well, I say Israel, the southern tribes, Judah, trying to hang on, trying to figure out what to do. They're the doormat here. They're getting beat back and forth, and Zedekiah makes a very bad move. He tries to rebel against the king of Babylon. Well, Nebuchadnezzar comes up and says he encamped outside the city and built siege works all around it. And so completely traps those people. And it says there's no food. The city walls are broken through. In verse 4, the whole army flees. At this point, we don't know what happened to the Ark of the Covenant. Nobody knows. A lot of stories of where it ended up, all the way down into Ethiopia. But who knows? People knew Nebuchadnezzar was coming, so the Ark could have been hidden inside Jerusalem, could have been hidden outside the city, could have been smuggled out and taken off someplace else. But the Ark disappears from history here, so we don't know what happened. Here's what I think is one of the most grim scenes in all the Old Testament. Zedekiah has been caught. And it says in verse 6, he was captured, he was taken to the king of Babylon at Riblah, where sentence was pronounced on him. And then, how grim is this? They killed the sons of Zedekiah before his eyes. Then they put out his eyes, bound him with bronze shackles, and took him to Babylon. I'm a father, and I can't think of anything more horrifying than seeing my sons killed. And they were killed in front of the king. Then they put out his eyes. So the last thing he saw was the bodies of his sons. And so he's hauled off. And it wasn't just hauling off some people, but it was a total destruction of the city. Verse 9, the temple is set fire. The royal palace is set fire. All the houses of Jerusalem, every important building was burned. Nebuchadnezzar carried into exile a lot of the people. Some of the poorest were left behind. Verse 13, this beautiful temple, if you can find a picture of that, take a look at that thing, the glory of Israel, sitting up on a hill, shining in the sun, attracting people. People sang songs as they came up to this temple to worship their God. And now, what's happened to it? The Babylonians broke up the bronze pillars of it, the movable stands, the bronze sea. They were at the temple of the Lord, and they carried it all off to Babylon. They took away everything. They just stripped this land. And they took away these pillars that were huge and trashed the whole thing. And then, again, a very sad verse, 21, getting near the end of 2 Kings. So Judah went into captivity away from her land. And that's it. That's where we're going to end up with the historical portion of the Old Testament here. We're going to switch next time and take a look at wisdom literature, take a look at some songs, look at these prophets, spend some time on the prophets because they were such a big part of the Old Testament. But that's the last time Judah really had a chance to shine, and Israel. And it's a sad time to end it.